You're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM WOMM LP, Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with Kate Harding, author of Asking for It, The Alarming Rise of Rape Culture and What We Can Do About It. Previously, she collaborated with Anna Holmes, Amanda Hess, and a cast of thousands on The Book of Jezebel, and with Marianne Kirby on Lessons from the Fatosphere. You might also remember her as the founding editor of Shapely Prose, which existed from 2007 to 2010. Kate's essays have appeared in the anthologies Madonna and Me, Yes Means Yes, Feed Me, and Airmail, Women of Letters. As a freelance writer, she's extremely proud to have been published in outlets called Bitch, Jezebel, Dame, and Broadsheet, among others. Kate holds an MFA in fiction from Vermont College of Fine Arts and a BA in English from University of Toronto. She's currently at work on a PhD in creative writing from Bath Spa University and was very pleased to join the Loft Literary Center as a teaching artist in the fall of 2015. A longtime Torontonian and Chicagoan, Kate recently moved to Minneapolis with her husband and two dogs. Every 7 minutes, someone in America commits a rape. And whether that's a football star, a beloved celebrity, an elected official, member of the clergy, or just an average Joe or Joanna, there's probably a community eager to make excuses for that person. In Asking for It, Kate Harding combines in-depth research with an in-your-face voice to make the case that 21st century America supports rapists more effectively than it supports victims. Drawing on real-world examples of what feminists call rape culture, from Politico's revealing gaffes to institutional failures in higher education and the military, Harding offers ideas and suggestions for how we as a society can take sexual violence much more seriously without compromising the rights of the accused. When I spoke with Kate Harding, I asked her to begin by talking about the expression rape culture. What does it mean, and why did she begin to write about it?
The expression has been around for probably at least 40 years. Feminists were using it in the 70s, and it's something that hasn't really penetrated the mainstream for obvious reasons. It's a very bold kind of statement. It seems counterintuitive. It suggests that we as a people are pro-rape, which I don't think we like to think of ourselves as, but it is a name for something that very much exists. And the reality is that we live in a culture that really protects the needs of rapists more than it protects the needs of victims and survivors. And what I mean by that is when someone reports a rape, she, and it's more often a she, is investigated and interrogated as if she herself is a criminal. There is very little chance that charges will be filed, let alone that a conviction will come. That if it is, quote unquote, he said, she said, or he said, whatever, then the assumption is that there is just no way to prove that a rape happened because you can't take this one person's word for it. Right. And it's not a coincidence that that one person is typically a woman in the way that we think about rape.
Yeah. The thing that really surprised me as I read this book was recognizing ways in which I have always understood that we do live in a rape culture in the way that we've just talked about this expression without it fully sinking in, In the book's introduction, you suggest that we reject people's pleas for any given person to imagine that it was your sister or your daughter or your wife who was raped. And you say, I'm asking you to imagine it's you who was raped, and I'm asking you to get angry about it. And I did. I got so angry as I was reading this book, but mm-hmm. I was a little bit angry at myself for not having thought some of this stuff before. It just exists in our culture, and how could I not have noticed?
Right. Well, right. No, I totally get it. I mean, the problem is you grow up in this culture, you're soaking in it. And that's a lot of what I want to point out here is that it's not that we're bad people. It's not that most of us are pro-rape. It's that we absorb all of these messages and develop a worldview out of that, mm-hmm. that if we don't take the time to question it, we're going to just keep perpetuating the same kind of myths and stereotypes and damaging attitudes towards victims. And I think that part of that is that that one of the things we do is we tend to identify with the perpetrator instead of the victim. Mm-hmm. And again, gender is one reason for this, but I think also that women don't want to identify with the victim because there's, you know, at least an illusion of safety if we believe, oh, the victim, you know, she shouldn't have worn that, she shouldn't have gone to that place, she shouldn't have drunk or left with that guy. If you can tell yourself, I would never do those things, then clearly I am rape-proofed and it'll all be okay.
Right.
So, you know, we all do that to avoid living in fear. Women in fear of being raped, men in fear of being falsely accused. And the problem is those fears are not proportionate.
Right, right. And nor do they do anything to stop this from happening.
No, exactly.
Tell me, just to reference back to that that quote from the book, talk about why it's not helpful to imagine your sister or, I don't have daughters, but my niece, you know, why is that not a helpful thing?
It's, I mean, it's not completely unhelpful. It can be something that kind of breaks through a certain resistance to talking about rape in the first place. But again, it's something that others the victim. I mean, quite literally, it means you're thinking of her as someone else. And it also then tends to, that's something that we often say to men and make it about, you know, you should be protecting your women, essentially. And it's something that makes it not about the victim and makes people not think viscerally about what it means to be raped, what that does to your body, your mind, your spirit over time. Mm-hmm. And that's something that I think if we can't all take a moment to imagine what this really means, then we're not going to break through all of this resistance to calling rape what it is and really pursuing justice for victims.
Right. Let's see. Oh, I want to just read a quote from the book, which is, this was actually one of those moments where I was a little bit angry at myself because I'd never thought about this kind of an analogy before. You know, I'm a feminist. I grew up in the Mad Men era. I know how terrible things have been for women through the years. Anyway, you offer this great analogy about why, you know, it's hypocritical. You said prosecutors won't say it's too risky to charge a mugger because the jury will hear that the victim carried her purse in plain sight and thus vote for an acquittal. And I was like, what a great comparison. It's like, of course not.
Yeah, that's the thing. And you know, what's funny is that it's very hard to pin down numbers of how many reports of rape are false.
Yeah.
But the best estimates are that it's between 2% and 8%.
Right.
And the low end of that is actually similar to false reports of muggings and of burglaries. That there are other crimes that people just come in and pretend, or they pretend that they were attacked. And there are crimes that people report for much the same reason as women do rape or men do rape, for attention and sympathy, where they're not really looking to put someone in prison. But we don't talk about those. We only talk about the false report of rape because people think of it as basically, you know, a woman's word can ruin a man's life.
Right. And I assume that there's a huge factor also of an assumption that a woman slept with a man consensually and then decided the next day she shouldn't have. And
yes.
So that, but it sounds like these numbers don't really bear that out very much.
No, they don't. And that's something too that I talk about in the book, that that our idea of who makes a false report is itself false and very much a myth, because the people who do, the women who come in and make false reports, mm-hmm. as I said, they tend to be looking for attention and sympathy. They tend to describe a stranger rape, so they're not accusing someone in particular. There's no revenge motive. They mm-hmm. aren't actually looking to put someone in prison. They are looking to just have people pay attention to them and give them sympathy. And so they say, oh, I was, you know, beaten and raped by a man who dragged me into the alley or into the bushes, which is our stereotype of what rape really means. Mm-hmm. But in fact, that's a very small amount of rapes. More like 90% are people you actually know. Right. Large percentage of those are intimate partners. And nobody comes in saying, you know, well, I shouldn't say nobody. I'm sure it's happened in the history of the universe, but people don't typically come in saying my boyfriend raped me, which is probably the, you know, one of the more typical rape scenarios. They yeah. come in saying someone I don't know did this.
Right. You have a great chapter subtitle that I need to mention before we talk about what it covers. Men are from Earth, so are women.
Yeah.
Can we talk a little bit about the theory that men and women are just wired differently, and this results in miscommunication that contributes to sexual assault or mistakes around what was going on, that sort of thing?
Right. I mean, you know, I'm not a neuroscientist, but there is this, I don't really buy very much into this idea that men and women have these vastly different brains, process information so differently that we can't possibly understand each other. You know, that means that when you're having a consensual sexual encounter, or one that you perceive to be consensual, if someone is not into it, there's no way you can know if right. it's a heterosexual encounter. And so what that, you know, there is this myth of miscommunication that is, so people commit rape by accident under this theory, right? That, mm-hmm. you know, that's what they always say. Like, if a woman says she was raped, the man says we had sex, but it was consensual, then it's, oh, well, maybe he just didn't know. How am I supposed to know? You know, the rules around consent are so complicated and difficult, and women say no when they mean yes. And all of this is just, you know, a smokescreen around the real issue, which is that consent is not rocket science, that right. if you are paying attention to how your partner is responding to you, you're going to know right away if something is wrong, if they need you to stop, and that we are, in fact, very good at reading, at indirect communication, at reading body language and cues from each other. So it's one of those things, again, where it's only in this context that we act as though men and women are speaking completely different languages and can't possibly understand each other.
Right.
Yeah.
why do you think it is that so much of our society seems to have more sympathy for the accused and feel disapproval for the people who come forward as victims of rape?
Right. Well, so, I mean, it's a couple things. It goes back to those fears that I was talking about earlier, where for women, it's the fear that they will become victims unless there is a way that they can protect themselves. And so it's this false empowerment that comes from thinking that if you don't do X, Y, Z, you will be able to protect yourself. Mm-hmm. And for men, it is that fear of being falsely accused. And I want to acknowledge that, I mean, that's a, you know, very deep and understandable human fear, the idea that you could be accused of a crime you didn't commit and suddenly thrown into that Kafka-esque nightmare.
Right.
But I do like to remind men they are more at risk of being raped than they are of being falsely accused of rape, and that it would actually be very rare if they are practicing affirmative ongoing consent with their partners. It's extremely unlikely that anyone is going to accuse them of rape. And so being able to put that fear into its proper context and then look at this rape culture where we've designed so many things around protecting the accused, and I mean, the rights of the accused are hugely important, let me say that, like, as a,
sure.
as a civil libertarian, but we have lots of protections in place for the rights of the accused.
Right. So you actually, you mentioned the statistic that 92 to 98 reported rapes are substantiated ultimately based on some research that's been done. Only 2 to 8% of accusations are found to be lies. That's one of the statistics in the book. The statistic that really, really stood out for me in the way that it was worded was on the back of the book, every 7 minutes, someone in America commits a rape. And, you know, that just really struck me because we are so used to hearing the flip side of that statement. Every 7 minutes, someone in America is raped. But you flipped it on its head and you were like, someone commits a rape. And right there, you've got us thinking about the fact that there is a perpetrator in all of these crimes. It's not yeah. just the victim. There is somebody who is committing this crime. And I thought that was really smart, the way you did
yeah.
that.
Thank you so much for noticing that and calling it smart, because I did, that was totally deliberate and for just that reason. And in fact, when I first did that, so now people could learn that I wrote my own cover copy, it was a collaborative effort with the publisher.
Yeah.
But it did start with, you know, every 7 minutes someone is raped. And then I went, wait a minute, like, take my own advice. What am I doing here?
Yeah.
That this is part of the problem is that we don't, I talk about rape being our only perpetratorless crime, you know?
Right.
That we act as though it's always women get raped, women are raped, people... And again, I want to just keep reiterating that it's not only women who are raped. Most of these rape culture messages are very much about men and women in a sort of heterosexual scenario. And so it's hard to talk about this without sounding really heterosexist. But it's passive voice. It's like, you know, it's that thing that you're supposed to learn in Comp 101 that you should be using active instead of passive voice. And what that does is, it takes the focus off the people who are committing the rapes and then puts it on the victims and what were they doing and what, you know, how did they bring this on themselves, essentially. And it also allows us to continue to embrace the myth that the rapist is this boogeyman monster that, you know, is not someone that we know in our real lives.
Right.
That it's someone who is out there as this, you know, threatening specter.
He's a bad guy.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. And it really strikes me in reading your book, how much of the onus is on women to protect themselves and be walking around prepared for the bad thing to happen instead of the onus being on our society to fix this.
Right.
Right.
I think, and that was one of the things that, you know, as I was learning about rape culture over the years, that was one of the things that really clicked for me, where I was like, wait a minute, you know, this is stuff that I do seemingly instinctively, and it's actually because I have been fed all of these poisonous messages, which is, again, this idea that if women restrict our behavior and our movements, then we can avoid being raped.
Right.
And the problem with that, of course, is that it means we're restricting our behavior and our movements, and it's still no guarantee against being raped, and it also means that we're not participating in society at the same level as men are allowed to and expected to, because no one is going to blame them if they, you know, quote unquote, get themselves raped.
Right.
And let me say, of course, there are plenty of people who will blame any victim, but it's, you know, a man is not going to be questioned about what he was wearing.
Right. Yeah, this is, I think, related. You mentioned at one point in the book, you have no patience for anyone who insists that women must learn self-defense moves and memorize lists of specious advice to protect our own victimization. We're already calculating risks and taking reasonable precautions every day. And then you go on, I loved this, you said, you should still engage in this ritualized expression of anxiety with me because it makes me feel slightly better about things I can't control.
Right. That's the thing. It's like, you know, because you always get this resistance when you talk about that. And I'm not saying, you know, self-defense can be a great thing, especially if it makes you feel more confident walking around. But that it's not a method of rape-proofing yourself.
Right.
The ritualized expression of anxiety is... it's something that makes us, you know, it's all we have, basically.
Right.
That's the problem, is if somebody says, okay, well, so I'm giving up on the idea that self-defense and other, you know, different kind of precautionary measures and devoting a lot of your mental energy and physical energy to rape-proofing yourself, like, okay, if I say that all of that is BS, that it's rape culture, that it's not going to work, then what do I have left? The rape myths and the things that we're supposed to do to protect ourselves become almost like incantations. You know, it's a sort of magical thinking about that stuff that if you take that away, I got nothing.
Right.
You know, I'm just walking around vulnerable.
That's right. Yeah. I can have my superstitions, or I can have my religion, or I can
right.
have my keys in between my fingers as I walk into the parking garage.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly. Yeah.
When I was a teenager, I went to an all-girls high school, and we had a class called Sex and Family Living. And this is a long time ago. And we had to read a book called How to Say No to a Rapist and Survive. Have you ever run across that book?
No.
It has a lot of advice about not finding yourself in a situation where you could be attacked, and then advice for how to fight if you do get attacked, and then advice for how to not get yourself killed if you can't fight off your attacker. And, you know, I think it probably had some good information for us, but by the end of the semester, we were pretty much terrified. So your book obviously is very different from this. Your book is not looking to give those specious lists
right.
of advice. But so I wonder if you can talk a little bit about what your opinion is about a book or an article that covers that kind of information, and what should we try to take from it, and what should we maybe try to work harder around
yeah.
it.
I mean, first of all, and I did, I'm not familiar with that particular one, but I certainly did in college go to at least one, you know, sexual assault awareness event that was really about self-defense tips for women and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that one of the things that I hear in what you just described to me is that it is probably a very close cousin to kind of purity culture and the idea that you're supposed to be saying no to sex in general.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that is a big problem too, where we focus so much on women fighting off men, and that goes along with really outdated ideas about what sexual relationships are supposed to be and how it is this transaction where the woman is supposed to resist, the man is supposed to keep pushing past that resistance. And I think that is simply not the reality of how we have sex today.
Mm-hmm.
And by continuing on with that myth, we are then also propagating a false reason why someone would go in and make a false report. You know, one of the ideas is, oh, women have sex and then they regret it. And so then they go and they report someone for a violent crime because they regret having sex. And I just feel like in 2015, outside of, you know, certain closed communities, I don't see people having such regret for consensual sex and such embarrassment and shame about that, that they are going to then go and, you know, accuse someone of a crime falsely for it. But as long as we still embrace this idea that both sex and rape are two sides of the same coin, where a woman is resisting and a man is pushing past it, and it's all about how much she can do to fight it off, we're not going to cut through that kind of confusion.
Yeah. Okay. I want to, if you don't mind, do you mind if I read something from the book?
Sure.
Really quickly? Okay. So, according to the GOP's finest, ovulating around the time of your rape is sufficient evidence that you're a liar, not a victim. These geniuses have basically created a 17th century Salem standard for abortion eligibility. If you'd been legitimately raped, your super secret cervix shield would have activated when it detected the presence of unsolicited ejaculate. The fact that you get pregnant proves you don't deserve to end that pregnancy, but if you drown, you were innocent, and your reward will be in heaven. I think that's how it works. So, I'm asking this question because I want to convey how funny your tone is in this book. It's, you know, it's angry and appropriately so, but you are very funny. And that surprised me. It works so well, but I wasn't expecting to be reading a funny book. Maybe because it's snarky is how it works so well, because so much of this is so ridiculous. Some of the political stuff in particular and the reporters. Did your editors encourage the humor, or did they ask you to tone it down in any areas? I'm curious.
Definitely. That was encouraged, and that was part of, even, you know, from the proposal stage, my voice was one of the things that they really loved, and that they knew that would make it palatable for mm-hmm. the audience. And for me, it's just kind of the natural thing, because as you said, so much of it is so ridiculous and so absurd. And really, my reaction too is, we've been talking about this at some level nationally for so long,
right.
And we're still so screwed up about it. We've made no progress. So it's like, my entire approach to all of the material is just like, what is wrong with us? Are you kidding me? You know, as opposed to, I'm going to do this very sober academic explanation of what rape culture means. It's like, no, come on, get it together, America. So yeah, it's kind of, and then you hear politicians say things like, you know, if it was legitimate rape, her body would shut that whole thing. And it's just like, what century am I even living in?
Right. You have this one section where you talk about different, actual expressions that real politicians have used: forcible rape, honest rape, legitimate rape, emergency rape, and my saddest one of all is Whoopi Goldberg with rape.
Oh, yes.
Which was like, no, Whoopi, no.
No, I know. And
anyway, just crazy.
It's, yeah, it really is, and it really goes to show, like, these things come out of people's mouths before they even realize what they're saying, and it just really shows us how messed up our ideas about rape still are. And I mean, some of it is generational. Most of the people who are saying that are, you know, older than me. I'm 40. But at the same time, like, there are also plenty of people that age who are not screwed up about it, and there are plenty of people who are younger who still hold to the same myths because that's what they've been raised with in this culture.
Yeah, and I would add that it strikes me that some of these statements have been made by people whose religious values go along with that whole purity thing that we were talking about before. And right. So they aren't even considering that this is going to be a part of the conversation they have to have at the podium because it is so far outside
right.
what they
yes.
have to think about on a regular basis. Their handlers didn't even talk to them about
right,
this, right?
And that, you know, and they're all trying to thread the needle where some of them will come right out and say that, you know, if a pregnancy comes about through rape, well, that's a gift from God, because in their religious tradition, every pregnancy is something that God put there on purpose.
Right.
And I mean, and I understand that from the point of view of kind of intellectual consistency or religious consistency in that case. But then the problem is you can't come out as an American politician and say rape is a gift from God.
No.
And so... it's very interesting to see people trying to signal to their fellow religious people, you know, or their fellow religion mates,
yeah.
that they do believe that God put the pregnancy there, while also trying to not sound completely heartless and insane.
And foolish.
Yes.
I mean, to some extent, it's funny reading your book, you know, and you said both in the introduction and toward the end that you could have kept writing this book forever because these things keep happening. These statements keep being made yes. in the media. Things keep perpetrating the next event, the Cosby situation, for example. And I was thinking, you know, to some extent, it's like the comedians who are like saying, I'm going to miss Donald Trump when he falls out of the race because
yeah.
he gives me so much material.
It's true. It's, you know, there's definitely no shortage of it. And, you know, I would certainly love to come to the point culturally where there's no need for a book like this anymore and it can
sure.
just quietly go out of print. But, yeah, it was really frustrating because I kept trying to move towards an endpoint, and then it would be like, oh, now there's a whole other huge story where even in April, this book was in edits and it was considered finished. And then my editors were like, you have to talk about Bill Cosby somewhere.
Yeah.
And I knew too that there would be a lag between when we put the book to bed and when it came out. And there were some things. There was the St. Paul's case in New Hampshire. There was Patrick Kane, the Chicago Blackhawk, was accused of rape, and that's something that I would have talked about. There have been, you know, and it just keeps going on day after day, that mm-hmm. there is no shortage. When I started writing about this stuff, I mean, apart from, you know, I've written about it for years on some level, but I started a Tumblr in 2012, just kind of logging these instances of rape culture in the news, where whether it was about the reporting that was just so uncritical or the report was on some instance of someone horribly victim blaming, whether it was a judge or a police officer or mm-hmm. man on the street, you know. And that was when I realized after several months, like, I can just keep doing this daily indefinitely, was when I decided, okay, I think this is a book.
Yeah. Yeah. There's one example in the book that I think kind of covers a lot of the things you just mentioned, and that it's the behavior of reporters in this case. Your Bill O'Reilly story took the cake. I could not believe this. I have to admit, and maybe this is because I don't watch his show, but I didn't remember this being in the news stream. He made statements indicating that Sean Hornbeck, a little boy who was abducted and kept for 4.5 years by his captor, who raped him regularly during his captivity. Bill O'Reilly says he probably didn't try to escape because he had it better in that situation than he did at home, where there was homework.
Yep.
I have never, I mean, like, are you serious? Like,
right, I know, I
what?
Know. It was so beyond the pale. I mean, I'm obviously not Bill O'Reilly's biggest fan, but I can't believe that came out of his mouth and that, you know, he even to his audience had to apologize for that, but was very like, oh, well, I hope I'm wrong.
Right.
What's interesting, and again, I don't think there was much reporting outside on that. I'm pretty sure that I got that from Media Matters, which is actually a watchdog of right-wing media. So that's something where, you know, I found this incredible instance of victim blaming, but it wasn't like there was mainstream media reporting, like, get a load of what Fox just said the other day. What's funny is right now, just the other day, that excerpt from the book ran in Salon, and I'm getting Twitter comments today saying things like, oh, well, but didn't O'Reilly really put forth an idea and not a conclusion? I guess the left doesn't want to discuss anything. And I was like, yes, his idea is that, like, a boy who was kidnapped by a pedophile enjoyed being held captive and raped. But it was just so vile and odious. And I, you know, I like to think that even O'Reilly just kind of, it started spilling out of his mouth and he was like, well, whatever, I just got to finish the thought now, you know?
Right.
But yeah. It's just, yeah, the idea that, and that is something that we do with these, you know, fortunately rare, but very dramatic cases with Sean Hornbeck, J.C. Dugard, Elizabeth Smart, all of these kids who were held captive for a very long time. We say basically, like, how did you not escape? That's the level to which we take our victim blaming, that children can be kidnapped by adult predators who have, you know, in many cases, elaborate plans to hold them captive indefinitely. And our first question to those kids when we find them is, why didn't you escape?
Right.
You know, it's really, you know, one of the most absurd examples of how quick we are to blame the victim.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about the journalism thing a little bit more. This book does offer suggestions for helping our culture recover from this. And one of the really concrete things that you did was offer some examples of how journalism should be responsible in covering these cases. So can you just talk a little bit about that?
Well, I think there are so many things. One is, and it's a matter of, it's something that not necessarily the journalists who are writing about this are going to do, but headlines need to be aware of that passive voice and need to be aware of things like something you frequently see, it will be about a child rape, and it will say, man charged with having sex with, like, a 9-year-old.
Yeah.
And there is no having sex with a 9-year-old. It is always rape. And that, it's a small, subtle thing, but it leads to this conflation of sex and rape where it's always a murky thing and maybe, you know, there's some room for interpretation. There's absolutely no room for interpretation when it's a child. And then there are things like you frequently see with Steubenville, with this gang rape in Cleveland, Texas, of an 11-year-old girl. Reporters will go and interview the community, and the spin of the story will be like, these poor boys and their lives have been ruined by this. It's interesting and can be useful to get that opinion and to report on it when that's part of the community's opinion. But journalists have taken this idea of objectivity to mean that they don't have to apply any critical thinking skills to the material that they are synthesizing and reporting to us. And right. I think when one side is saying it's terrible that this girl was raped and the other side is saying it's terrible that these rapists are suffering consequences, like, you are allowed to make a value judgment on which one is more true.
Right.
And that's something that I think we see too little in reporting. And that generally speaking, I am not even a fan of kind of the journalistic concept of objectivity. I'm a much bigger fan of transparency. And I would rather see people just be open and transparent about the biases that they bring to it, about their political opinions, than trying to pretend that they are this kind of omniscient, all-seeing eye that has no opinion and no personal stake in anything that they're reporting on, because I think that's just, you know, it's impossible. There's no such thing as an objective human.
That's really interesting. So the way the news has evolved, where a lot of the times we really do know what people's political opinions are, that you embrace that?
I do. And I mean, I think it's part of why I have almost an easier time dealing with something like Fox News than I do with, you know, a CNN that's purportedly objective, but then often seems to be, you know, extraordinarily conservative.
Right.
And, you know, and even something like MSNBC, where I'm, you know, I'm way farther left than most of their politics, but I can acknowledge that, yeah, that one is more liberal, Fox is more conservative. And what frustrates me is when, you know, right-wingers talk about, like, the New York Times as liberal media, which is right. Hilarious to me. But if people are honest about where they're coming from, then I can evaluate things in that context, you know? If I know that you are religious, if I know that you vote Republican, if I know that, you know, this is your world, then I know we're coming at it from two very different angles.
Mm-hmm.
But if you try and cover that stuff up and say, I am coming at it head on, straight down the middle, it becomes one of two things. Either it's biased and you're just not admitting it, or you just set out those, here is one side, here is the other side, and I'm, you know, not interpreting anything, and I'm just putting these things out there. There's a thing happening today, actually, in the news today, that South by Southwest, the big tech and music and just enormous conference now, they have canceled two panels on gaming, because one was about how harassment of women is a huge problem in the gaming world,
mm-hmm.
and the other was about how basically we need unbridled free speech in the gaming world.
Okay.
So South by Southwest organizers start getting a whole bunch of death threats and harassment about the harassment panel, and so they canceled both of these, and they call it strong community management, and they say that because we want to have a big inclusive tent and remain open to ideas and civil discourse, we had to cancel both of these panels, including the one that is about how vicious the harassment of women in gaming is, has been canceled because of harassment.
Wow.
And that's the thing, and it's this false equivalency of, you know, two sides that are very much at odds, and people are afraid to even say things like, no, you know, harassment is bad, we're going to take a stand against harassment. The opposite of harassment is not free speech, you know?
Right.
And people just don't think that through.
I was really interested in the chapter that you have about gaming and that community, and, you know, just, it's so discouraging, although you do sort of show us at the end how technology and the internet are also contributing to helping, but there's a lot that's really bad about it, and is making this so much worse. So that's interesting. Another subject in the book that I thought was excellent, and it sounds like you get a little bit of criticism for this, but you talk about the importance of teaching boys to actively oppose sexual violence. So you write a lot about this in conjunction with your presentation of the Steubenville rape case and the ancillary video of the kid reacting to what he saw on the first video. It's all that was so horrific, the whole story, just so horrific. But as far as teaching boys to actively oppose sexual violence, that just makes so much sense. And I don't understand why anyone would have a problem with your saying that.
I think people really want to be able to separate the world into criminals and non-criminals as if this is something we're born with and not necessarily something that comes about, at least in part, as a result of culture and upbringing and education and all of that. So people really resent this idea that people need to be taught not to rape, that people need to be taught what consent is, what it means, what healthy boundaries are, because the idea is supposed to be, well, if you're not a born criminal, then you're just never going to rape anybody, and that's the end of it. Mm-hmm. The problem is, all of these people who, you know, supposedly don't fit the profile of the born criminal, who then will go back to that miscommunication myth if they ever are accused of rape. And, oh, well, I just didn't know what it was. And it's like, well, you can't have it both ways.
Right.
Either nobody needs to learn how not to rape, or we need to discuss this so that we're not worried that, you know, about miscommunication and the accidental rapes. But I think it's, you know, there was just an incident in the last couple of weeks where a young man in England was a college student, and he was expected to take some kind of consent awareness program, and he got very frustrated by that and said, you know, I am not a rapist. Why are you treating me like I'm a rapist? And I think that we need to be able to draw a distinction between, I am presuming that, you know, you are criminally minded, that you're going to go out there and rape people, and I am presuming that as a person raised in this culture, maybe you need some education on what consent is.
Right.
And I think, you know, we all need that education, and in fact, the studies that have been done of what kinds of programming works in terms of sex ed and sexual assault awareness. It's stuff that is aimed at younger kids, like middle school, junior high level. It's stuff that takes place over a period of weeks with a whole, you know, extensive curriculum where one lesson builds upon the next. And it's not, we can't wait until kids get to college and then give them an hour-long seminar and expect them to really understand healthy boundaries.
Right. Absolutely. You give another statistic in the book that surprised me. In spring 2013, New York's Margaret Lyons, New York Magazine, wrote that of 135 scripted dramas on the air, 109 had featured a rape or murder in the previous season.
Yeah.
I don't know why that shocked me, because of course they all have murder or rape, but it shocked me. And you know, just the fact that Special Victims Unit exists as a show unto itself. On the other hand, you do not endorse censorship of entertainment media. So, can you talk a little bit about these two truths?
It's often a double-edged sword where, you know, you look at something like SVU and it drives me nuts, and I talk in the book about the things that they do that kind of promote rape myths. But also, there was just a study released, and I mean, small sample size and who knows, but saying that basically people who watch SVU are in fact savvier about rape and rape myths than people who watch like CSI. And that there is something where I feel like they've been trying to do some good along with all of kind of the havoc that they have wrought. And that SVU, you know, that show is almost 20 years old now and came up at a time when there wasn't as much of a conversation about it on TV. But so that's only one example. So it's harder to defend something like, you know, somebody talking about beating and raping a woman in a song that's going to be popular, that kind of thing. But, you know, I am anti-censorship. I am pro-critical thinking, and I am pro, you know, typically I don't look to the free market for a solution for things, but in the case of entertainment media, I feel like if people think critically about this stuff and start to reject the things that are just about myths and stereotypes and misogyny, you know, the problem becomes self-correcting. You know, it's hard to know, and of course, you know, I'm not a media scholar, so I don't know that much in terms of what has been shown about the effects of seeing all this violence and becoming desensitized and all of that. I do think that as a creative writer, it is kind of lazy storytelling, where what's fascinating about that statistic to me is that, you know, with all of these scripted dramas, that nearly all of them are dealing with rape and murder, like the absolute most extreme high stakes thing. And it's like, if that's what you go to immediately, you know, where do you have any room to maneuver dramatically and to kind of raise and lower stakes as you go along? It makes for not necessarily very interesting storytelling, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the other thing that strikes me is that a lot of this entertainment media is aimed at kids, and when you just take something away from kids, they want more of it. Whereas if you let them think about what they think about it, then they're more likely to, like you say, have an informed critical opinion.
Yeah, one hopes that they don't just passively absorb it. Yeah, and who knows? But I think typically that, or generally speaking, that you know, taking things away from people, you're right, just makes them want it more, whether they're kids or adults. So
right. I was going to ask what you're working on now. Are you writing another book, or are you working on something new?
I am working on a novel and a PhD in fiction now.
Oh wow!
And so I'm doing that through Bastbaugh University's Low Residency Program, because I fell in love with Low Residency at Vermont College.
Yeah.
And it's about 19th century feminists, and including Victoria Woodhull, the first woman who ran for president.
Yes.
And, I'm hoping that I'll have that finished up around, you know, summer or this time next year, and then I can start trying to sell that one.
Now, you have an agent. I know that I saw that in your acknowledgments. Does your agent handle fiction as well as nonfiction?
She does.
Okay.
So we'll see. I mean, of course, I have to just get the novel written before I can see if it's worth bringing to market. But
right.
That's what I'm working on now.
And how about books that you've read recently? Not just nonfiction books, but any book that you've enjoyed that you might share.
Sure. Well, okay, so two things that are related to that project. One is biography by Myra McPherson called The Scarlet Sisters. Okay. That is about Victoria Woodhull and her sister, Tennessee Claflin, and that was something that I read for research, but also is a super enjoyable read.
Okay.
And Jamie Attenberg's book, Saint Maisie. I love that novel about a woman who, during the Depression, worked at a movie theater in the Lower East Side, I think, and became kind of like friend to all of the out of work guys and the homeless people around in the neighborhood. What I loved about it is that that's a really interesting hook, but it also, she is such an amazing character who is not just this, you know, totally saintly person who just helps everyone. She's got a complex in her life and she's a wonderful character. So.
Oh, okay. Great. All right, I just have one last question for you, Kate. And these are sort of related. Oh, they're related. So you do share in the book that you were raped, and I found it really interesting that you held off on sharing the particular story of your own rape until the end of the book. I didn't necessarily want to get into the details of what happened to you, but I wondered why you made that choice as a writer to wait and share that at the very end. So that's the first half of this question, then I'll...
Sure.
Yeah.
So it was a couple things. I mean, one, I had tried it in different places. I considered not talking about it at all because it's not necessarily relevant. You know, I'm happy to talk about it in interviews and say that this rape over 20 years ago is what sparked my interest in rape culture and mm-hmm. feminism, for that matter. But one thing I really wanted to do with the book in general was get away from the, like, here are a bunch of sob story case studies of, and I don't mean sob story to be dismissive, but just that so many of the books on rape are just case study after case study that is just this really sad, harrowing description of a rape that is partly, you know, the purpose of it is essentially to convince people that these kinds of rapes exist, that they really are trauma, that, you know, speaking especially of acquaintance rapes, that kind of thing.
Right.
And so I wanted to start from the premise that, like, if you're reading this and you're not sure about whether acquaintance rape is a thing, then, you know, you're not ready for this book yet.
Right.
Like that is a given.
Yeah.
So I didn't want to necessarily dwell on those a whole lot, including my own story, which was a, you know, very typical kind of campus rape. And then it just sort of worked out at the end because I was talking about campuses and college rapes and the amazing student activism on campuses mm-hmm. right now, actually, that is one of the things that really gives me hope. And so it fit there contextually better than it did anywhere else in the book. And it also, you know, I was able to make my case before I told my personal
yep.
story. So, it, you know, that, like, here is how this stuff applies to the culture, and then here's how it applies to me. And I think that doing it that way instead of the other way around will give people a different perspective on my writing.
Yeah, it's funny. I almost felt the same way about the presentation of your story as I did about that line on the back of the book, someone in America commits a rape, not someone is raped. And I feel like basically instead of starting out and saying, this is my story, and then moving into how it fits into the larger world, you present the larger world, and then you said, oh, and also, as you know from mentions in the book, I
yeah.
have a story, and I've decided to share it with you. I don't know. I thought that made it a little bit more about your point, which is rape culture, and less about Kate Harding. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, thanks. And that's definitely part of it, too, that I was trying to write a work of, you know, cultural criticism in the sense of criticizing our actual culture.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I didn't want to make it all about me. And also, you know, there are plenty of people who will still dismiss everything I say because as a rape victim, I can't be objective. You know, it goes back to that thing again of, like, I want to be clear about my experiences and biases, but I also want to give you a chance to just take my argument as it is before
right.
you see. And again, like I said, it was over 20 years ago, which doesn't mean that it doesn't, you know, continue to have ripple effects, but it's not something that is very raw. I don't know that I could have written this book 15 or 10 years ago.
Yeah.
Because my story would have been so much more at the forefront of my mind as I was doing it.
Mm-hmm. The second half of my question actually touches on what you said, some people wouldn't believe you. But I was just wondering, for other writers who might be listening, writers of nonfiction, I'm thinking specifically, can you offer any advice for researching and writing about a subject in which you have a personal stake? Like, how did you check in with yourself? How did you, you know, you were talking about journalists before and objectivity and critical thinking. So how did you check in with yourself and make sure that you felt like you were doing a good job with this book?
I think, well, I mean, it's a couple of things. I think one of the biggest things was just sort of basic fact-checking principles, where I tried to make sure that I had at least a couple of really good sources on any statistic or observation that I was putting forward. And that if I was saying something, you know, here's a fact or here's what we know, then I wanted to very clearly footnote it and make sure that my sources weren't, you know, terrible, that it wasn't like, you know, a crappy little study that meant nothing. It wasn't somebody that, you know, clearly has a huge bias that they aren't acknowledging in their work, that sort of thing.
Right.
And then the other thing was just to be as transparent as I could be myself. And again, to tell you where I'm getting all of my sources, to tell you how I'm approaching things as I go through it, so that, you know, you can make your own adjustments according to what you think of my kind of research methods and skills. And the other thing is, I think when you have that personal stake in it, was there were times when I really had to take breaks, where I would just get so enraged and it wouldn't be the kind of like useful, fiery, righteous anger. It would just, you know, it would just corrode into despair. And I had to just stop working on the book sometimes. And that meant it took longer to write than it would have. But I really kind of toggled between modes, where when I was researching, it was just very much like I was kind of researching any other subject and just trying to employ all of the best practices that I know. But then when the material started to get under my skin, it'd just be like, okay, I need to put the book away for a week.
Right.
Go do something else.
Okay, great. I want to mention the name of the book again, Asking for It, The Alarming Rise of Rape Culture and What We Can Do About It, by Kate Harding. And your publisher is DeCapo Press, Lifelong Books. Kate, thank you so much for being on Write the Book.
Thank you so much, Shayla.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Kate Harding. You can learn more about her work on her website, kateharding.info. This week's Write the Prompt was inspired by my interview with Kate Harding, and specifically about our discussion of politicians and the media. Write a scene in which a politician or journalist makes a statement or argument that is stranger than fiction. It can be ridiculous or outlandish, strong in some way. Surely our culture has seen an actual example that is just as shocking as what you can come up with, but try for outlandish. And then rewrite the scene in another manner. Do not change the character's point of view, but change the way in which he or she presents that point of view. A politician who might find a smoother way to convey his or her offensive message. A journalist who might offer two points of view and then an opinion. Study what changed between the two scenes and keep that change, the strong, inartful message versus the subtle or shrewd or slick message, in mind as you write going forward and create characters going forward. Good luck with this prompt, and please listen next week for another. Write the Book and The Radiator are supported in part by Calamity and Crows Trading Post, twisting fresh tie-dyes for individuals, businesses, and organizations with standards like eyeballs, Jerry Bears, peace signs, and their signature tie-dyed mule, custom artisan tie-dyes that rock. Contact Calamity and Crows Trading Post on Facebook. And by The Farmhouse, Burlington's farm-to-table gastropub, serving award-winning burgers, innovative entrees, and a world-class craft beer menu. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know. They can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3. Archived episodes of Write the Book are also available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and Write the Book Radio Show on Facebook for updates. Also, we'd like to ask that you rate the show on iTunes. That does a lot to help the show. If you can offer a review, that's even better. The show hasn't had a lot of new reviews or ratings lately, and so I'm going to just put it out there. If you would be in the mood to do that, that would be a great thing. You can also access the podcast at my own website, which is shelaughswithoutus.com. My co-host, Gary Lee Miller, has a website as well. His is garyleemiller.com. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. I will just tell you that tomorrow I'll be conducting a live interview at the South Burlington Community Library at noon. I will be interviewing the poet Daniel Lusk about his new collection of poems inspired by the works of Vermeer, and that book is called The Vermeer Suites. That's tomorrow at the South Burlington Community Library at noon. Please do remember that this station is here thanks to community support and involvement. More information about The Radiator is available online at theradiator.org. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you are listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM LP, Burlington, Vermont.